On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 48 hours, Condoleezza Rice told the world. For 48 hours, Israel would stop air operations over Lebanon after the weekend's death toll at Khana, except in response to imminent threats. And 12 hours later, airstrikes resumed. A million Israelis have huddled in bomb shelters. The burials and Hezbollah resistance go on in Lebanon. The fighting will go on, too, the Israeli government said yesterday, at least until a potent international force shows up, if it shows up. But the battlefield in these weeks of fighting goes far beyond Lebanon and Haifa. It's a battle of perception, and that also matters. Up next on Point, the message of the fighting in the Middle East, how it's seen, how it's heard. Later in this hour, Ambassador Indyk will join us. But joining me first from Paris is Christopher Dickey. He is Paris Bureau Chief and Middle East Regional Editor for Newsweek magazine. Christopher Dickey, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom.
And from Beirut, Lebanon, Rami Khoury. He is Editor-at-Large of the Beirut-based Daily Star newspaper and an internationally syndicated political columnist. Rami Khoury, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
I'd like to ask each of you first, just to give us your sense. I'm sure you're watching the local and regional media and are also aware of the American media. I'd like to just get your sense, and Rami Khoury, you mentioned this last week when we spoke with you, but we didn't have a chance to delve into it. Your sense of the difference in image, in portrayal of what's going on in this region between American media outlets and what you're seeing in the region.
Yeah, there's a huge difference. The American, by and large, the mainstream American media are picking up on the White House and the Israeli spin, which is that Hezbollah is a terrorist group. It's an arm of Iranian foreign policy. It's a threat to Lebanon. It's a threat to the region. It wants to constantly keep attacking Israel or killing Jews or killing Westerners, and it has to be rooted out. It cannot be the only armed militia in Lebanon. We must implement Resolution 1559. And Hezbollah started this fight on July 12, and they must be rooted out once and for all. This is what the American government, the Israeli government, and a few other people around the world are saying, and virtually all the rest of the world is saying this is either vastly exaggerated or complete nonsense, and is simply a ideological extremist view from the White House and from Israel. The Arab media, I think, is giving exactly the opposite, that Hezbollah is a legitimate indigenous organization that was born in the early 80s precisely to fight the Israeli occupation of Lebanon. It is a progeny of Ariel Sharon's policies. It is a reaction to the inability of Lebanon and all the other Arab governments to do anything about Israeli occupation and attacks and subjugation of Arabs. It has close ties to Iran, and there's nothing illegal about having allies in the world. It is the only group that has ever been able to fight the Israelis to a draw, and therefore it is eliciting a lot of support all over the Arab world.
Very different perceptions, certainly different points of emphasis. I must say, Rami Khoury, in the American media, and we're looking here at perceptions drawn by media, I have seen many, many images of destruction on both sides of this border, and by no means any shortage of bomb craters and all the rest in Lebanon. Can you compare the visual impact of what Americans are seeing and what people are seeing on Arab television in the region?
I think what you're seeing in the Arab media is more of the destruction that Israel has brought about in Lebanon, more of the terrible images of the dead kids, babies, and small children in Khana and other places in South Lebanon. We monitor very carefully the American cable networks that we get and the Arab ones, and you get the basic story is more or less the same, but the spin on it, the interpretation is different, and the depth into which the Arab media goes in showing these images is much, much greater. And the problem is the American media, again, with some exceptions, but the mainstream media says, well, yes, Israel is creating his bombing in Lebanon, but the Hezbollah brought this on, it's Hezbollah's fault, they shouldn't have done this, and this is what they get for attacking Israel unprovoked. So they tend to, the American media shows the Israeli bombing impact in Lebanon, but then tends to generally justify it as this is the fault of Hezbollah, and it's not the fault of Israel. Israel is just defending itself and has a right to do so. And this is, you know, the problem with this is that the American media and the Israeli media have been saying this for about 45 years now. And every time we have a war in Lebanon, it just gets worse and worse and worse. So at some point, intelligent people, reasonable people, rational people would wake up and say, wait a minute, if we have to do this every 7 or 8 years, there's something fundamentally wrong with this policy. It's not achieving our goals, but very few voices are raising those points in the U.S., unfortunately.
I'm sure we'd get many views on what the fundamental issue here might be. Rami Kurian in Beirut, please stand by. Christopher Dickey, let me turn to you in Paris. You know this region well. You reported intimately, and you live in Paris. We're looking for the lessons that are likely to be drawn from this fighting, and it begins first with just what people see and read and hear. How would you compare how Europe is perceiving and being shown this conflict with what you see of American coverage?
You know, the irony of what Rami was saying is that all of the things he was describing in the American press and in the Arab press are true. Iran is behind Hezbollah. Iran did help to create Hezbollah. Iran has subsidized Hezbollah. Hezbollah did start this war. I think everybody understands that. The problem is, where do you put the emphasis and what do you say is an appropriate reaction to that? And in Europe, certainly, there's a feeling that the reaction of the Israelis has two major problems. First, it's extreme. It's slaughtering lots of innocents. Maybe a third of the hundreds of people killed in Lebanon are children. And secondly, it's not working. A lot of people, I think, in Lebanon as well as elsewhere, would be very happy to see Hezbollah marginalized or destroyed. But that is not what's taking place. And one of the things that the Europeans appreciate, and I think this is one of the reasons that you see such a widening divide between Europe and the United States, is that this is a policy that even by its own terms, Israeli and American terms, marginalizing, destroying Hezbollah, is not working and is not going to work. And as a result, you're going to have a situation where lots of innocent people will be killed, Lebanon will be greatly destabilized, and Hezbollah will probably wind up stronger, not weaker, than before. None of that is anything that is wanted in European policy circles. But that is what people here see happening, and it's what the United States, particularly the Bush administration, and I would say particularly the White House, refuses to recognize.
And what about the pictures in Europe and the reporters' interpretations from the ground? I don't know how much American television you get to see. How different is your portrayal? What's your sense of that difference between, I mean, whether you agree or disagrees, it's important for Americans to understand how the rest of the world is seeing this, or much of it is. Is there a difference in just the simple presentation of what's happening?
Well, there's a lot more interest, in fact, in Europe than there is in the United States. This is not the number one story in the United States.
It's pretty high, pretty high, pretty high.
No, it's pretty high, but Mel Gibson drunk driving is just as high. There are lots of issues in the United States that take precedent because basically what Americans are not involved and don't want to be involved around the world. The United States has always been essentially an inward-looking society, which is ironic given its global power. And if you talk to Americans, if you look at the way this is covered, if you look at what people are actually tuning into, and we see this on Newsweek's website, what are people reading? What they're reading are not the stories about the Middle East. They're not reading the stories about the carnage in Lebanon. They would rather change the channel, and I think they're doing it. This is one of the things that, in fact, the Israelis are relying on, is that if they just keep up this offensive, keep pushing, it all becomes background noise. And because of a 24/7 news environment where there's just such a rush of information all the time, Cana, which happens on Monday, will be forgotten by Friday.
Why do you think Europeans are looking more closely? Is it simply because of geographic proximity? They feel this on their doorstep. They're worried about how it may spill over. I'm reading the French foreign minister saying, you know, that he's worried about this devolving into a clash of civilizations. Is that the European fear on its doorstep?
Of course, that's part of it. 10% of the population of France is Muslim. So anything that inflames Muslim public opinion and creates a sense of a clash of civilizations is a vital concern to France particularly. But it isn't just that. It's that historically, Europeans have more experience in this region, and they have more experience of the kinds of things that are important in the Middle East. Take the word occupation, for instance. Occupation is a word that's essentially meaningless to Americans. The United States has never been occupied. We never claim to be occupying other countries. We're always liberating them. But in Europe, every country has been an occupier or occupied or both in modern memory. And as a result, people understand the kind of humiliation that's associated with that, the kind of anger that's associated with that, and all of that is central to the basic issues in the Middle East, whether the Palestinian issue or the Lebanese question the Iraq question. Mm. And that's one of the reasons that they understand it, and Americans just don't.
Do you see anti-Semitism in Europe's view of the fighting right now?
I don't, but I think there's a danger of anti-Semitism growing not only in Europe, but in the United States as a result of this. You know, you see, it's interesting to watch American policy and how closely linked it is under the Bush administration to Israeli policy. And we seem to be in this vortex of deeper and deeper involvement in the Middle East. And the question keeps coming up, why? We know Saddam Hussein didn't have weapons of mass destruction. We know he wasn't behind 9/11. Why are we so deeply involved in this question with Lebanon now? Or conversely, why are we not more deeply involved? Our traditional role was to keep a certain kind of distance and act as a peacemaker, but we're not even doing that. So there's a lot of confusion about the Middle East, I think, in American public opinion, but there is a sense that somehow Israel is at the heart of it.
Chris Dickey, Rami, it's one thing to look at people's perceptions and the picture that they're given, but then, of course, people draw lessons from what they see and hear. I want to ask you both, and we can kind of mix it up here, but Rami, how do you see the lessons being drawn in your region from this fight?
Well, I think the lessons are applicable to everybody, and one of them I'd mentioned in response to or to add to what Christopher was saying about the U.S. role and how Americans are not sure what their government's role in this region. I think it's very important to grasp the one lesson here, which is that the United States is actually very marginal right now in this process. I mean, Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State of the strongest power in the world, was unable to come to Lebanon, the country that 6 months ago she was holding up as a poster child of America's policy of promoting democracy in the Arab world. I mean, it's extraordinary what happened on Sunday when the Lebanese prime minister stood up and basically said, Condi Rice, thanks but no thanks, hit the road. And she did, and she went back to Washington. This is a very powerful and unprecedented signal of exactly what America's standing is. It's not talking to the important players now that are emerging, Syria, Iran, Hezbollah, and Hamas, and the Muslim brothers all over the region who are winning elections. It's unable to even come to Lebanon to address the issue because the Lebanese government won't talk to it. And the only people who can talk to in the Middle East are so-called moderate Arab governments who barely have any impact beyond their guards and their families. And it's a very, very, very difficult.
Christopher Dickey, do you see that? Do you see in Europe the United States standing in this whole issue diminished? Or is Europe still looking to the U.S. to take the lead and work something out?
The United States' standing has been diminished as a result of its involvement in the Middle East every day since the end of the invasion of Iraq. Every day of the occupation of Iraq, U.S. standing has diminished. And I think everybody in this part of the world understands that. It's not something I think that people really want to see. I think people want to see a strong, wise power in the United States that can do good around the world. But that isn't what they've been seeing, or that's not what they say they've been seeing. They see the United States caught up in deeper and deeper involvements it doesn't know how to get out of, and involvements which compromise its power in exactly the way that that Rami's talking about. To the extent that Israel is seen as an extension of American power, to see Israel, this country that could defeat every Arab army that was against it in 1967 in the course of 6 days, now 21 days into the battle against Hezbollah and no real end in sight, suggests that there has been a huge shift, if not in raw military power, at least in the sense of awe that that power generated, both American and Israeli. And that's a very dangerous thing for Israel and for the United States, because it basically means it's open season on both countries. And I think that's part of what the Israelis are reacting to, but it's also something that the Europeans are reacting to. The U.S. doesn't seem to know what its best interest is, and Israel doesn't seem to know what its best interest is. And I think what you've seen recently is the Europeans trying to step in and saying, don't you understand that you have to have a ceasefire for your own sake, not just for Lebanon's sake, but neither the United States nor number 10 Downing Street is listening.
But isn't that exactly what Israel is saying, in effect? We can't stop here until we have something like a victory. Israel, and by extension or implication, George Bush, when he lays down such severe or strict requirements for ceasefire that it's obvious it won't come soon, isn't he saying the same thing? We can't afford to take a loss here.
We interviewed a young Israeli reservist last week who said he was sick of this gambler's mentality, basically having to double your bet constantly. You go into Lebanon, you don't get the results you expected to get, so you have to go in more into Lebanon, and then more into Lebanon, and you have to bomb it more, and you have to kill more civilians. That's too bad. You're really after Hezbollah, but, gee, hundreds of civilians are dying, and you have to do it more and more and more because your policy is not succeeding. It's failing more and more. That's a trap. That's exactly the situation where normally, in the past, if Israel got itself into that situation, and it did in the past, the U.S. would step in and say, pull back. No, you just got to stop. But now the Bush administration is saying, yeah, we'll just go wherever Israel wants to lead us on this one.
Rami Kouri, Christopher Dickey saying that U.S. and Israeli standing and power so far seem to have not been enhanced, but rather significantly cut by this fighting. What do you think are the lessons that people watching in the Middle East are taking from that? Would they agree? And what's the implication of that? Does it strengthen Hezbollah? Does it change the chemistry of this very, very long-standing conflict?
I think the lessons so far, and we have to be very careful here because this is an ongoing conflict, and my guess is the Israelis are going to pull out all the stops in the next 3 days with massive military attacks against probably a lot of more empty houses, as they've been hitting mostly over much of Lebanon. But they'll be hitting some Hezbollah positions and some rocket launchers and things like that. But we have to see what happens when the dust settles. If Hezbollah has been degraded or not will determine a lot of the implications. So far, right now, Hezbollah has become very popular all around the Middle East. It has, I mean, what's happened is that the non-state actors like Hezbollah and Hamas have basically grabbed the legitimacy and the credibility and the popular support, which Arab governments have been unable to develop in many cases with their own people. And people have seen Hezbollah stand up to Israel now for 3 weeks, and they're still firing rockets into northern Israel. And this is something that people in the Arab world are pleased about. They're not pleased to see people being killed on either side, but they're pleased to see some Arab group fighting the Israelis to a standstill, which I think opens the door to a negotiated settlement. I think this is really how we should look at it, that this is an opening not to keep fighting, but to having a fought to a draw to say, all right, let's now, neither side is going to win, let's shift to a diplomatic settlement.
But that's exactly what Israel can't afford, is to fight to a draw. It has
Israel
to fight to a victory here.
Right, and this is the problem. And the U.S. and Israel are both looking, I mean, the United States is looking at this through the lens of 9/11 and the great terrorist threat and the messianic visions of George Bush and the neocons and some of the very conservative Christian groups that support them. They have this great messianic vision of terrorism in the Middle East. But Israel is focused much more on its own security doctrine and its own survival, and they see this as an existential threat. But the point is those two visions have converged, and they cannot be seen to be defeated militarily. But I think what I'm hoping that what they'll see is that, and this might be more evident to the UN this week, they'll see that this is an opportunity to achieve through political means the kind of stability and peace and acceptance and long-term survival that they have not been able to achieve through military means.
Chris Dickey, what about that existential threat? Rami Kouri says this may open the door to negotiated settlement, the vision of these powers fighting to a draw. But might that not just as well open the door, encourage Hezbollah to go for the whole show here? Iran has poured a lot of money into Hezbollah and talked about wiping Israel off the map. Do you agree that this draw, if that's how this should end, and as Rami Kouri says, we have no idea yet, but if it should, does that really push toward negotiation, or does it push toward, fighting for all the marbles?
Hezbollah doesn't begin to have the resources to wipe Israel off the map in any way, shape, or form in terms of military power. Hezbollah's game is all about public opinion. It is all about being the last man standing. It's all about being 4,000, maybe 5,000 fighters taking on the most powerful army in the region, backed by the greatest power in the world, and surviving. It's all about winning Arab public opinion, not just Shiite public opinion, but Sunni public opinion and Muslim public opinion all over the world. And it is achieving all those goals. I think Rami is exactly right. Although Rami's holding out the possibility of some kind of draw that would lead to a negotiated solution, what we really are going to see over the next few days is hugely stepped up Israeli military action. You're going to see them trying very, very, very hard to kill Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah. And you're going to see them pushing with an increasing land offensive up into southern Lebanon to create really not a buffer zone, but a free fire zone. And all of that is going to cause endless problems. But Israel is intent on doing it because it has to say, Ehud Olmert, the prime minister, has to say to his people, we have a victory. And they have to convey to the world the idea that they remain the power that they were a month ago.
We're going to hear later in this hour from Martin Indyk, former U.S. ambassador to Israel. I want to hear from our listeners as well. Let's turn to them. Christina's calling from Toronto, Canada. Hi, Christina. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. What do you think, Christine? What do you hear?
I hear unbelievably embarrassing that Mr. Dickey, I mean, says what he says. I mean, a victory is not what I think Israel is after. I think Israel and the United States are the only courageous countries out there that are willing to say what's right and what's wrong. And basically, you know, this is wrong. Muslims around the world are creating problems everywhere. They have 9-1-1. I mean, you can, you know, go down the list in the name of Islam. And so thank God that we have USA and Israel fighting the bad guys, because there is a right and a wrong. And this is such spin from Mr. Dickey. It's embarrassing for the United States to have people like that. That's basically my comment.
Let me put it to my guest, Christina, and we've got it. You hear it, Chris Dickey. What do you say?
Well, look, welcome to the Clash of Civilizations. It's not me saying that this is the way it should be. I'm simply describing the situation as it is. I wish that the United States were pursuing a policy that were bringing peace to the region. But I think it's certifiable that the United States policy since 2003 has done exactly the opposite. I wish that Israel, frankly, I wish that Israel had been able to succeed in the first two or three days of battle in Lebanon, and had really had the intelligence and the resources to seriously weaken Hezbollah. But it didn't. So what we have is a situation of ongoing fighting, and a rapid deterioration of American and Israeli interests in the region, putting aside the moral question of waging a war in which a third of the casualties so far are children in Lebanon.
But, you know, the complaint has often been put to Europe that it's not courageous enough to step up and take a stand on anything. Christina says, look, the U.S. and Israel are identifying right and wrong. They've got courage. Is Europe prepared to act in this region in a way that might help settle it down?
Well, you know, look at the question of the multinational force that's being discussed to go into Lebanon, particularly South Lebanon, and create some space for peace in that area. The American idea is that that would be a really robust force that could go in and fight Hezbollah. And the European attitude is, yeah, we will go in. The French will lead the force. But we're not going to go in unless we have some understanding of exactly what we're supposed to do and how it's supposed to be done, and basically unless all the parties concerned will allow us to go in. We're not going to fight our way in to resolve this war that Israel started. Why? Because they remember that's exactly what happened in 1982. In 1982, Israel rolled all the way to Beirut. And the next thing you know, you had the Sabra and Shatila massacres. The world was outraged. Government and constitution and agreement were imposed on Lebanon that the Lebanese didn't want and the Syrians really didn't want. It became a deteriorating mess. And by 1983, you had 241 Marines and 56 French soldiers blown up in a single day.
Rami Kouri, what about the issue of a robust international force? I mean, without it, doesn't Hezbollah just rebuild on Israel's border and we're right back where we started?
Well, I think your question is not fair. This is not a battle between Hezbollah and the international community. This is a battle between Hezbollah and Lebanon on one side and the Israeli government and army and people on the other side. I think if we're going to look at any international force or any way to solve this problem, we have to look at the legitimate demands of Israel and the Lebanese. An international force will not be brought into this region. Nobody will do troop to it. unless you get his butler's approval, and that will only come if the outstanding issues between Israel and Lebanon are both resolved. The prisoners, occupied lands, cross-border attacks, all the issues that have been raised. And these are solvable issues. They've actually negotiated them and solved them before, and they can be solved very easily. So I think the international force issue is one that will come after there is a political decision. But I just want to answer Christina quickly two
yes.
points. One, if she's right to raise the issue of right and wrong, and if that's the case, you know, Israel is the country that has been most criticized by the UN Security Council and most condemned in UN resolutions. So Israel clearly is the country that has done more wrong in this region, according to world standards, if we accept the UN Security Council, where the U.S. has a veto. So I think she should look more clearly at who's right and who's wrong. The second more important point is what the U.S. has done in the last couple of years in Afghanistan, Iraq, Palestine, and Lebanon, by promoting this doctrine of military use to promote freedom and democracy, has created four countries, Afghanistan, Iraq, Palestine, and Lebanon, where there is chaos, warfare, greater anti-Americanism, stronger Islamist movement, small groups of terror, delegitimizing moderate Arab governments, stronger sentiments against the U.S. and Israel. So the U.S. is doing exactly the wrong things to promote the kind of policies it wants to promote. So I think it's time for people to stop looking at simplistic issues of right or wrong and to look at the realities of people's lives, what people want, and how to respond to them. And I repeat again, we must look at the Israeli and Arab people's legitimate demands. I'm not saying Israel is wrong. I'm saying Israel and the Lebanese both have legitimate demands. If we don't reply to them both, we're going to just do this again, and we'll be back here talking about this in 5 years and 10 years.
And what about the voice of Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda standing in the background here? I mean, isn't the U.S. right to be concerned about that?
Of course. I mean, Osama bin Laden's a criminal. 9/11 was a terrible crime, and the U.S. was absolutely right to lead a global coalition to fight al-Qaeda and any of the other groups who were doing this. But to confuse al-Qaeda and a small group of criminal terrorists hanging out in caves in various places or in the suburbs of New Jersey and Hamburg, to confuse them with people in Arab countries fighting for their liberation of their country to live a decent life is a great mistake. It's a huge confusion in the minds of Americans and Israelis who are doing this. And if you look now, you know, Hassan Nasrallah and Hezbollah are the big heroes all around the Arab world, and al-Qaeda is being pushed into the background. Al-Qaeda has not caught on with the masses of people in the Arab world. The majority of Arabs don't support terrorism, don't like Osama bin Laden.
We're talking this hour about the message in the fighting in the Middle East, how it's heard, how it's seen in the region and beyond. We've been joined from Beirut by Rami Khoury, editor-at-large at the Daily Star newspaper there. From Paris by Christopher Dickey, Paris bureau chief and Middle East regional editor for Newsweek magazine. And right now, from Washington, by Ambassador Martin Indyk, U.S. ambassador to Israel, 95 to 97, and again 2000-2001. He's director of the Saban Center for Middle East Policy and senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Ambassador Indyk, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
You've been listening. We've heard a pretty stern critique here of Israel and the United States in the middle of this fighting, the argument being made that it's counterproductive and getting both of them into a pretty big hole. What do you think of this lesson taken from the fighting?
I think that's basically correct. I think the time has come now to focus on the diplomatic outcome that can be achieved in the difficult circumstances, both for Israel and the United States. I think Israel has been flat-footed in its military campaign, and the United States has been extraordinarily flat-footed in its diplomatic campaign. But at this point, the most important thing is to try to find a way to achieve a ceasefire, bring the Lebanese army into southern Lebanon and to police the border with Israel. That should be backed by an international force that has a mandate that's very different from the previous international force, the UNIFIL force, which was just an observer force, but actually to provide a robust capability to the Lebanese army as it extends the Lebanese government's authority throughout the country. Those are objectives which the Lebanese government has endorsed. And I think that's the immediate challenge, to try to get that to happen.
Let me ask you about a key perception from Rami Kouri in Beirut, saying if these forces fight to a draw, that is Israel and Hezbollah, that would open the door to a larger negotiated settlement potentially around the whole Arab-Israeli conflict. Do you see that, or do you see a Hezbollah that fights Israel to a draw as being emboldened to go after a policy of, you know, pushing Israel off the map?
Well, it's wonderful to have my friend Rami see a silver lining in this very dark cloud, especially since he's in Beirut, I gather. And
yes,
to see anything bright from there is amazing in these circumstances. I suspect that it's based on precedent, which took place in 1973, when Anwar Sadat managed to launch war against Israel, and although he actually lost the war, the regaining of honor enabled him to make peace with Israel. And perhaps Rami is referring to that because dignity and honor are so important in the Arab context of centuries of humiliation. And so that may be true if we had Anwar Sadat's around, but the problem is Sadat led a strong government, centralized authority in Egypt. He was capable of making tough decisions and turning the ship of state around. Unfortunately, in Lebanon, what we've got is a weak government that is getting weaker by the day, which I think is another important reason why we need to convert to diplomacy here. And that government has not been able to control Hezbollah, which, as you point out, Tom, has a different agenda. It's an absolutist agenda, and it's an agenda that's backed not by the Lebanese people, but by Iran and facilitated by Syria. And so the challenge here is to build up the Lebanese government. That's why the international force is important. That's why what Rami refers to as these other issues, which are very minor issues of territorial adjustments and prisoner swaps and so on, can be achieved in a way that would strengthen the Lebanese government. It has to be the Lebanese government's victory, not Hezbollah's victory, on those other issues. And hopefully then a process can be established where the Lebanese government will be able to extend its authority over all of Lebanon. That's the hope in this situation. Mm-hmm. I think it's a stretch to believe that we can solve all of the Middle East problems, particularly the Israeli-Palestinian problem, on the back of this particular crisis.
Rami Kouri, you hear Ambassador Indyk saying the international force on that border is the key element here. You heard Christopher Dickey earlier quite skeptical about that. How do you see it? Is that the key piece in this puzzle?
I think it is a key piece, and it really depends on the context in which it comes into the region. If this is an international force that's being brought in to finish the job that the Americans couldn't do with 1559, the resolution of the UN, and the Israelis couldn't do with their military, and this is now going to be a third attempt to bring in an international force to disarm Hezbollah, it won't work. They'll be attacked and defeated by Hezbollah, which has driven the Americans out of Lebanon, driven the Israelis out of Lebanon, and they'll drive anybody else out who comes in there trying to control them. If the force comes in on the back of a ceasefire and a political agreement that legitimately responds to these issues, which Martin correctly, as usual, says are minor issues, really, you know, Sheba Farms, Shuba, some mined areas, prisoner exchanges, and stopping the attacks. These are all issues that have been negotiated before and agreements were reached. So the bilateral Israel-Lebanon dispute is actually very narrow and relatively simple. It's not a complicated issue like the Palestine-Israel one of contested land. So if you solve those problems and have a context, a political context that brings in an international force with the agreement of Lebanon government and Hezbollah, which strengthens the Lebanese government, then I think it could be a positive thing if it also guarantees that Israel isn't going to attack Lebanon anymore. So, and that can be done. So I think that's what we should aim for. And the 7-point plan that the Lebanese government put forward last week with Hezbollah's approval is an extraordinary opening, I think, which I wrote about in my column tomorrow to plug my column, which is an extraordinary opening. I think that people should really study and look at more carefully with the Lebanese government, Hezbollah agreeing on something that talks about all these issues in various ways is something that we should study and push.
Christopher Dickey, do you see the international forces, the key element here? Israel saying it's going to go on fighting until it's got Hezbollah pushed back, or that force is there taking care of that. I mean, is it going to happen? And if it happens, is that the way out?
It's not going to happen unless it happens in a context like the one that Rami Khoury is describing. And it's hard to see how we're going to see that anytime soon. I'd be curious to know from Ambassador Indyk, why is the U.S. policy so flat-footed at the moment? Why has the United States been so reluctant to play its normal role of stepping in and sort of saving both sides from themselves?
Ambassador Indyk?
Well, first of all, Tom, I just want to emphasize,
yes,
what I was talking about as the key was not so much the international force as the strengthening of the Lebanese government. That is the key, because it's only if the Lebanese government is capable of exercising its authority over the whole country that the state within a state that Hezbollah has managed to establish can start to be dismantled.
But Hezbollah is part of that government. That government's manifestly not had the strength to do anything about that.
That's correct, and that is part of the difficulty here. But the challenge is to have the international force back up the Lebanese government in its exercise of authority. That's what the Prime Minister wants to do, and I think he has the support of the people for that. And Hezbollah is, the challenge is to put Hezbollah in the corner and take away any of its justification for continuing to operate as a state within a state. That's why these other minor issues that Hezbollah has been using to justify its continued resistance need to be resolved.
And Chris's question about the flat-footedness of Washington?
Well, it starts with an administration that doesn't believe in diplomacy. That its default position is, we do policy, we don't do diplomacy. Diplomacy was something that they felt that the Clinton administration did, and they didn't want to have anything to do with anything that the Clinton administration had done in the Middle East. Their default position has been to disengage from any effort to resolve these Arab-Israeli conflicts and to push a very different agenda, which is a democratization agenda and a regime change agenda. And in that context, this president got involved in Lebanon. And the enemies of this process of democratization were, first of all, the Syrians, and the Lebanese people succeeded in pushing the Syrians out. And the last step, which wasn't completed, was Hezbollah, who was acting as an Iranian agent in Lebanon. So for the president, this is all part of his larger war on terror, in which democratization is the answer, not peacemaking.
I want to try and get one more caller. We've had such a good conversation, I haven't turned enough. Richard's calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, Richard, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. This question is probably best answered by the ambassador, just because of his work with Israel and the U.S. government.
Make it quick, Richard. Our time is short, please.
I'm sorry. I wanted to ask about this amazing chasm between U.S. policy and then the world's policy and the world's views. I can certainly understand how the American people, due to the media and everything, how they feel about Israel. But I guess I just wanted to know more about how this administration feels that it's so righteous, that it has such a moral upper hand, and that it's almost engaged in anti-diplomacy over there.
Let us take it right there. Martin Indyk, how do you see the root of that? Is it 9/11? Is it the length of the U.S. relationship with Israel? To what do you source the difference in worldviews here?
Well, there are a number of factors, obviously. The first is the abiding commitment that every administration has had since the creation of the State of Israel and its recognition by Harry Truman to the survival and well-being of the Jewish state, seen as created out of the ashes of the Holocaust, seen as a democracy in a very hostile region. Not just administrations, but the American people have tended to identify with Israel's struggle for survival. And that has been even more the case in circumstances where, after 9/11, the Middle East looked like a very hostile place for Western interests and for countries that were identified with Western interests, like Israel, which was seen to be on the front line against terrorism, which it was facing from the Palestinians at the same time as the United States was fighting the terrorism of al-Qaeda and bin Laden. So I think that's at the heart of this, that Americans generally, but the administration in particular, see this not just as a fight for
Israel's survival. After all, Israel withdrew from Lebanon 6 years ago, and it's been attacked by Hezbollah in an unprovoked act of aggression. But beyond that, they see this as part of the war on terror.
Yeah.
Hezbollah and Iran are very much part of that rogue's gallery of enemies.
An amazing gap in perceptions, and I'm grateful to each of you for helping us look into it today. Ambassador Martin Indyk in Washington, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Rami Khoury at the Daily Star in Beirut. Rami, be safe, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And Christopher Dickey, Paris Bureau Chief and Middle East Regional Editor for Newsweek Magazine. Christopher Dickey, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Tom. Always a pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.